You're listening to the ESP, the European Skeptics Podcast, an independent weekly show set out to bring you news, interesting topics and interviews with people mostly from Europe, building bridges and breaking down language barriers to show the world how active and awesome the skeptical movement is in the region. This is episode 404. I'm your host, András Pintér, and joining me for the show are my co-hosts, Annika Harrison and Pontus Böckmann. Sziasztok!
Hallo!
Hey son, guys! How's things?
Well, we just got an error message.
Do we need to restart?
No. It was just a bad joke. A bad attempt at a joke.
Oh, okay, 404. It's the 404 episode. Yes, that's right. Not this episode. We'll never be found. We should actually put that on the website. If you try to locate it, it will first say this episode could not be found, and then later below that, just kidding, click here. We can do that. Or not.
Probably not a best idea. Okay.
Probably not. I hope everybody can hear us. We are this is the second episode, or will be the second episode, that we release on Acast, which is the other supplier that we... I don't need to promote any specific supplier, but we switched from SoundCloud to Acast because SoundCloud was acting up and didn't push out the episodes. So I hope everybody can hear us on this brand new platform. Same old content, though, except I hope we have some news to come with later today. I have one thing, actually, I want to give a shout out to, an external thing. It's a tool called the Conspiracy Test. It's pretty cool, actually. It's an international effort and a collaboration between the University of Queensland, Australia, and schoolofthought.org. Very international. There's some UK people there, but it's actually registered in the US. Doesn't matter, but I think it's interesting for everybody. One of the persons behind this is Sander van der Linden, whom we interviewed here on the show way back in episode 180. But the Conspiracy Test is an educational tool in the form of a game that you play online on in your browser, and you select from a large number of conspiracy theories, like 5G, QAnon things, and the moon hoax, that we never went to the moon, any kind of that, famous conspiracy theories. And you start by rating yourself on you give yourself a skepticism level, and you want to be at 100% you're skeptical against these conspiracy theories. But you rate yourself, and then you go through certain steps. And then after each step, when you've learned new information, you can change your rating. You could go down or you could go up. And you don't actually win anything, but it's interesting. It's fun. I played through a couple of them, and I'm pretty impressed. The graphics are good and fun. At first, you're confronted by a lizard. It's all 3D, 3D animated. He's in a spaceship, and he talks about how delicious your stupid brain is to eat. But then he gives you different tasks to look at. At some point, it's a little bit slow and repetitive, but the production value is very high. It's clearly based on science-based learning theory. It's only in English, though. And even with subtitles, it can be a bit hard to follow if your English skills are not excellent. But all in all, it's very good. It's a good tool, I think, for teachers of students in the age group 13 to 18. But you could do it as an adult as well. But both entertaining and educational, I think. I recommend it. We'll put the link in the show notes, not the other way
around.
That
sounds cool, yeah.
How long has this been out?
I think it's pretty new. I couldn't find exactly. I found it through our friends in Australia, because it was mentioned by Tim Mendham in the newsletter that he sends out. Mm-hmm. So it's new. I mean, it's pretty new, because the conspiracies are up to date. I can tell you that.
Okay, speaking of being up to date, there are new developments around and new events coming up. This might just miss the timing of the next European Skeptics Congress that we haven't been able to release anything about yet, but it's in the works. But what I'm talking about now is the 2024 Convention of Humanists UK.
Mm-hmm.
So this is pretty big. I mean, the Humanist UK is a massive organization. They have 110,000 members.
Ooh.
And they bring together a lot of people. So last year, there were 30 people among the speakers, like campaigners, politicians, historians, comedians, scientists, all kinds of people, and pretty big names as well. The lineup for 2024 is pretty impressive as well. I don't know if you've heard of her, Dr. Helen Czerski. She's a physicist and oceanographer. Probably more well-known names among skeptics is Professor Jim Al-Khalili, who also happens to be the vice president of Humanist UK, and Adam Rutherford, who we interviewed on this show as
Guest on the show, yes.
Yeah, pretty impressive list of names. And I understand that the limited number of early bird tickets are still available, but they are going fast.
When is the convention?
Oh, sorry, I forgot to tell you. It's between the 14th and 16th of June 2024.
Ah.
One thing is not completely clear to me. That is whether it is open to anyone or just members. But my impression is that members have some kind of a discount on the tickets. Mm-hmm. So I would assume that this is open for anyone. And based on the testimonials from last year, it's going to be a blast. You definitely want to be there.
Very cool.
I think the UK people are just very good at organizing these kind of things. Or is it a coincidence?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are you trying to refer to QED by any chance?
Maybe a bit. Now, I also want to talk about someone whose very first or maybe second conference was QED in 2013. And that's Stefanie Dreifürst. Because I just put out an interview with her on my column for the Skeptical Inquirer online. I don't want to take away to the fun of reading through it, but yeah, we'll put the link in the show notes.
Pretty cool.
Oh, that reminds me that you've been poking me about that interview as well. And I just realized that I haven't been avoiding that. It's just, we just haven't got around to do it. Sorry about that.
Shame on air.
Shame on air.
But you're pretty active there, Annika. There's been a lot of interviews lately.
Yes,
how many,
it's fun.
Do you know how many interviews you've done?
I would need to count it.
Yeah. All right. Lots of them. All good.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, it's lots of fun.
Yeah, go on the Skeptical Inquirer website and look for Annika Harrison's name and you'll find all of her writings.
And I'm still very, very thankful that I've got this opportunity. So also thanks to Skeptical Inquirer.
Yeah, you also wrote a report from an event that was a year ago. Isn't that mind-blowing that it was a year ago that we were in Australia together?
Yes.
Unbelievable that a year has passed.
It was such a great time.
Yeah. And these guys are having their fun in Melbourne.
Yeah, right. I understand they're doing it without us this year, the bastards. But,
How dare you?
I'm sure it'll be a fantastic event.
Yes, and Susan Gerbig will be there. So I'm thinking about getting an online ticket.
Yeah.
Because it's cool. It's fun to watch. And I also like to support our Australian skeptic friends.
Yeah, let's put a link to that as well in the show notes so
people should definitely do that.
Yeah, and when is it happening?
The 2nd to 3rd of December in Melbourne.
Okay,
all right. So it's going to be soon. This is my very bad attempt at a Scottish pronunciation of the word soon.
Soon.
I know it's bad whenever I make an attempt. But the only reason why I try that is because this week in skeptical history marks the birthday of a real Scotsman. Okay, and that particular Scotsman was Sir Charles Lyell. I don't know how familiar his name sounds to you guys, but I remember reading about him when I read Charles Darwin's works and some of them, because he was a great influencer of Charles Darwin. They were friends, actually. So, Sir Charles Lyell was born on the 14th of November 1797. He was born in Angus, Scotland. And at the beginning, he didn't really have scientific education. Well, back then it was difficult to get anyway. But his interest in all things nature led him to a fascination about geology. And when I say geology, in his younger years, it was just a field of science that had just been introduced. Like the great James Hutton, who was the predecessor of his, and he's usually being referred to as the father of geology. But one of the fathers of geology are the aforementioned Charles Lyell. Based on James Hutton's and John Playfair's works, he actually decided to go and find all the evidence that supports the idea of a long, long time having been available for the development of the geological formations and all the geomorphological phenomena that we see around us today. So that was basically in opposition to what used to be a very widely held belief in terms of how these formations and geomorphological things developed. Because Georges Cuvier, who was a big name in the science of the history of living organisms, he was in support of something that we call the catastrophism. He believed that the world developed in several large cataclysmic events that basically restarted the whole system. And in opposition to that, Lyell, based on Hutton's and Playfair's work, proposed something different, something more gradual, more along the lines of small changes happening through a long, long period of time can lead to more significant changes as a result. And that is basically what we still believe today. And when I say believe, we have a lot of evidence for that to be the case. In philosophy of science, it's called a uniformitarianism. So that basically means that we have an assumption. So we have a basic assumption that everything that is happening at the moment around us has always been like that. I'm not saying that the sun was shining the same way all the time. It's just the basic principles of physics and, as a result, geology, they haven't changed since the beginning of time. Lyell was more along the lines of popularizing those ideas, and he came up with a lot of very eloquent thoughts and ideas and gathered a lot of evidence to support everything that he says. He was studying volcanoes, formations of sedimentary rocks, and all that. And he found compelling evidence and he piled them all up to write the book that is still considered one of the basic works in geology. And that is The Principles of Geology. And that book had a massive effect on the way of thinking of Charles Darwin, because he had a copy of his book and it clicked with Darwin. So he was struggling to understand how everything could have developed to their current form. And when he put it all together with the proposed unbelievably and unfathomably long periods of time, it just made a lot of sense that he said that, okay, these small, teeny tiny gradual changes eventually can lead to massive changes in living organisms. And that is just amazing. And it's so simple and yet so important in understanding the world and in understanding how evolution works, how the world works. And this is why I thought that it's more than just science history lesson. It is the basis of how we think and why us skeptics try to be as thorough as possible when trying to assess the truthfulness of something. And I'm not meaning this in the philosophical term, but in the scientific sense.
Yeah. I mean, as long as Darwin was stuck with, I'm not saying he was, but if he had been limited to the idea that the world was just 6,000 years old or something, it would be very hard to explain evolution. But now,
oh, yeah.
Here's another theory that also points that this has taken a long, long time, and it all fits together.
Yeah, and the other thing is that Lyle himself was struggling with his religious beliefs when it came to the opposition of his ideas to what the teachings of the church were. Georges Cuvier's catastrophist ideas were more in line with the religious teachings because of the floodings, because of the catastrophic events, because of the cataclysmic events that were all brought upon us by God.
Yeah. That would fit with the Bible.
Yeah, absolutely. But when we're talking about millions and millions of years, oh my God, that changes everything. And that was a thing that a lot of people struggled with, including Charles Lyell himself. But he kept on going and he kept explaining it to everyone. And, well, he got all kinds of acclaim for his scientific work. And he was a member of the Geological Society. He was a member of the Royal Society. He was also a member of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences.
Yeah, so we have a history of doing that. We brought in all kinds of people from abroad when we couldn't do it ourselves.
But that is pretty good.
Yeah, it worked for us.
He was also, for a while, one of the presidents of the Geological Society, which is also a very prestigious title. And now the Geological Society of London has an actual award named after him. So the Lyell Medal, it's an annual given medal to anyone who has done exceptional work in earth sciences. So, and when it comes to earth sciences, we're not only talking about geology because, for example, Lyell did a lot of digging into the changes in climate as well. So climate change, I'm not saying it was coined by him, but he did use the changes of climates as one of the arguments and evidence to what has been going on Earth. So really cool guy. And he was born on the 14th of November. So, yeah.
Happy birthday.
This week marks his birthday. Well, he would be just a mere 226 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. A young fella.
Yeah, compared to the Earth, right?
Yes. Okay, speaking of young fellas, I'm wondering if this week Pontus pokes the Pope.
I sure will. So, again, Pope Frankie is getting hailed for being this progressive force in the world. Last week, Frankie and the Vatican made the headlines with the news that transgender people can be baptized and become godparents. Trans people could also act as witnesses on marriages. Well, when it comes to marriages, well, what a revelation. And this came as Frankie replied to one of these dubias that I have mentioned before. Mm-hmm. Dubia means doubt, and it's the name for a letter with questions in them sent to the Pope by a bishop. And this dubia was from July this year, but it wasn't answered until now. Very conveniently after the synod was over. But anyway, yeah. But it got a lot of positive press. It was hailed like a big turnaround for the church. The New York Times said, quote, Pope Francis lays out nuanced guidance in keeping with his vision of a more inclusive church, end quote. The headline in AP News said, quote, Vatican steps closer to allowing transgender people to be baptized as Catholics, end quote. The BBC characterized it as a, quote, move that follows attempts by Pope Francis to make the church more welcoming to LGBT people, and they also bundled it together with links to older headlines along the lines of Pope suggests church could bless same-sex couples, Pope and senior Protestants denounce anti-gay laws, and Pope indicates support for same-sex civil unions. So, how good news is this, actually, looking into it? So, the actual reply says that even if a person has undergone hormone therapy and sex reassignment surgery, they can still receive baptism under the same conditions as other faithful. But other faithful is a quote. The other faithful? I don't know. There are the trans people and then the other faithful. Anyway.
Well, they go against the will of God. So.
Yeah, well, I'm coming to that.
Okay.
So that may sound fine, but there's an important caveat saying that such baptism can be possible provided, quote, there are no situations in which there is a risk of generating a public scandal or confusion among the faithful. What does that mean, public scandal or confusion among the faithful? So shall we assume that the faithful is the congregation, the local congregation, or maybe it's the local clergy? And does that mean, in that case, that if they object or are scandalized by this, then it's not allowed? This is less than clear. I mean, this caveat should not be there. He should say, either you can or you cannot. You cannot say, you can do it, but not if it offends your own beliefs. In July, the Vatican released comments made by Franchi, these are other comments of Franchi, from when he met an Italian person who said that they were torn between the church and their transgender identity. So this is a person who's struggling. And just like the above, and so often when Franchi says something, it starts out sounding fairly good. It's quotable and makes the headlines. But when you look into it, it becomes terrible. So he started by saying to this trans person that, quote, the Lord always walks with us, end quote. Okay, sounds good. Comforting even. But then he added this, quote, even if we are sinners, he draws near to help us. The Lord loves us as we are. This is God's crazy love, end quote. So I want to break this down and translate it into, yes, God goes with you, he loves you, but you are a sinner, because that's what he says, even if we are sinners. So you are a sinner, you need help from God, and this is God's crazy love, which means that it's astonishing that he has this crazy love, and it's crazy that he loves you, even though you are what you are. So Franchi may be, quote-unquote, progressive for a pope, but he still holds terrible ideas, in my opinion.
And I couldn't agree more. Yeah, that is exactly what, well, probably many of us reads into this. Like, it's difficult not to see that the underlying meaning, yeah.
Yeah, but very often it's only the first part of what Franchi says that make the headlines. And then people who only read the headlines, they get the impression, oh, he's such a progressive and nice pope. I'm not so certain.
Yeah. Well, I'm pretty sure that he really means well. But,
I don't think he sees himself as evil. But who does? I mean, nobody sees themselves as the villain in a story or in their life story. I'm sure he thinks he's doing a very good job. I'm not so impressed, as you will know by now.
Yes. Yeah. We had a feeling that this might be the case. All right. So thank you very much, Pontus, for poking the Pope once again. And that brings us to the round of the news.
Yeah. And I want to talk about something. It's not new. I kind of mentioned it a few episodes ago. But now a show came out in ZDF, Neo Magazin Royal, and that is supplements and nutrition and the woo and pseudoscience that is connected to that. And this is pretty popular in the German media right now because, A, there was just a big show coming out about it. And on the other hand, it's really big because there are court cases connected to that. That's why I won't say the name because I want to keep this little podcast protected, but supplement companies sell food supplements and diet products. The problem here is that we know from several people from research and so on that supplements already are a bit questionable. Mm-hmm. There are supplements that, for example, my toddler daughter needed to take when she was still a baby that were like actual evidence-based that it's good to take that. But there are supplements that you probably don't need or you will never need if you have a well-rounded diet. If you're, for example, if you're vegan, you might have to supplement a few things like with vitamin B12. But I'm not going into the medical area either because you should never take medical advice from this podcast. But the problem here is that this company does very aggressive ads on Instagram and on other social media. And they're also claiming things that are unhealthy. They, for example, say the European agency for food safety, they say, hey, only take 2 of the pills a day, but you should take 8 a day, which is a lot over the limit of what you should healthily take in a day. Or they say, oh, I actually, with just taking this cumin product, I healed my colitis ulcerosa, which is a bowel inflammation sickness. And as if that wouldn't be enough, they're also targeting vulnerable people, like people with eating disorders, because they tell them, oh, this is the only way you can lose weight, and this is a quick way to lose weight. And a tiny bit of trivia that I also found interesting, they tell you to, oh yeah, to bake cakes or muffins with this special sugar supplement. And the problem here is that we don't know how healthy it is to heat this sugar supplement up. So you can say, okay, maybe I'll put it on after baking it, but this European Agency of Food Safety, they say you shouldn't heat it up over 120 degrees. And these recipes that this company also gives out, they ask for heating it up for 180 and so on. So, yeah, just roundabout, very difficult. And also up until a few months ago, there wasn't a lot of reporting about it. So I'm happy that it's happening now. It's also gruesome to see that, because this is something that I, on Instagram, got a lot of ads for. And as a skeptic, I'm always skeptical of supplements, so I didn't buy anything from that company yet, but it could have as well had. So it's really interesting and also really important that MedWatch, for example, but also the Science Corps and Jan Böhmermann are talking about this.
So what's the, is there a development there? Is there going to be a lawsuit or?
The lawsuit is happening, yes. Yeah. So
yeah, okay.
The development here is that A, there's a lawsuit, but B, that there's, yeah, this bigger show out. So there will be even more talk about that.
Okay. All right. I have a follow up to last week's news item about conversion therapy. So you might recall that suddenly it seemed like the UK government was backing down from earlier commitments to ban the dangerous practice of conversion therapy. Yeah. Yeah. The thing came up because it was inexplicably taken out from the King's speech that Charles gave last week. Now, the good news this week is that a new bill to ban conversion therapy will be debated in Parliament after all. A bill called the Conversion Therapy Prohibition Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity Bill, end quote, that's a long name, has been drawn first in the list of bills to be read in the House of Lords. It will come up there on this Monday the 20th of November. And that it is first on the list means that it has received the status as the most urgent in a ballot taking place in the House of Lords. But this is just the first reading, as I understand it, and it's just an introduction to the bill for the members there. There will be debates and committees and maybe addendums later on, so I don't know how long it will take or how long it normally takes. But at least the process has begun, and it seems to matter that it wasn't mentioned by the King last week in his speech, because that put all focus on it, and maybe that is why they're bringing it up just now. Or maybe it's just a coincidence. I don't know how they think. I don't know how lords think in the House of Lords. But it wasn't as bad as it sounded last week when we suspected that it might not happen.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good update.
Good news for once, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I've got good news as well. And it connects well with what Pontus said about the conspiracy test, because it's a very similar kind of development, and it's an application. It's basically a website, and it was developed by a Hungarian team of the debunkers and science educators. So the team consisted of one of the most well-known fact-checking organizations in Hungary, LAKMUS, And they are teamed up with AFP and also the IDEA Foundation. And they form, along with Political Capital, that is the organization that is led by Peter Kreko, whom we also interviewed before. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So these are a couple of these organizations that make up the so-called Hungarian Hub Against Disinformation. And that is basically the Hungarian branch of the European Digital Media Observatory. And they, together with the IDEA Foundation and the author of a well-known debunking site, Urban Legends, they developed something that they call Detecto, or Detecto. And this is an online educational material that is specifically targeting young people, like school age people, mostly high school. And it's intended as a good tool for teachers to teach young people between the age of 13 and 16 to find their way out of the labyrinth of disinformation that they come across online. They started developing this with doing a bit of research into what online content the young people in this age range come across usually, and what are the most important shortcomings of the educational work that is being done to develop their critical thinking skills. And now they came up with a very playful kind of online application that teaches them the basic concepts of disinformation and misinformation. And they are coupled with videos, and they have to categorize them, and they can do it over and over and over and again. And as they progress into a more of a critical thinker, they have a lot of feedback on how they are doing. So it's not necessarily a game. So I wouldn't necessarily call it a game. It's more like a test-based thing. So this is why it's mostly intended for classroom use, but it's a pretty good tool, and I recommend everyone checks it out who speaks Hungarian, because it's developed in Hungarian. And that is a very important thing, because unfortunately, our organization, Hungarian Skeptics, we don't necessarily have the human resources to go into the development of such things. And these amazing organizations, they teamed up and they came up with it. So that's pretty cool. And they are fact checkers, they are educators, they are researchers of online disinformation and misinformation. So I think this is a very welcome development. So yeah, I'm very so happy about it. And we're going to be promoting it like crazy.
Yeah, but that's good. I mean, because I assume that in Hungary, it's hard to reach out with these kinds of tools if they are in a foreign language, even if it's English. So yes, it's good that it's done in a local language. Excellent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And unfortunately, probably the most important obstacle will be the overworked and exhausted teachers. So because teachers have a lot of things on their plate right now in Hungary. So I'm not sure how successful this will be in the classroom, but we need it very badly. And I'm so happy that these guys developed it. And it just came out. So it's very fresh out of the presses as well.
Okay, excellent. All right, let's go back to the UK. We have criticized Rishi Sunak for his backtracking on fighting the climate crisis on this show before, and it's not just us. Many people have criticized him for that. The Conversion, which is an excellent website for the most part, has taken a look at this, and they have compared it to what the British public really thinks about the topic of climate regulations. And this is relevant because it seems like Sunak is trying to be populistic with his policies, including this. So what do the public in the UK actually want him to do? So they took a look at the survey, which they say is recent, but it was actually from May this year, which is fine. But it's from before the controversial reversals of policies that Sunak has recently made. The study itself is not without problems, I should say. It's based on paid internet surveys, which means that the participants got paid for filling them in. And this is a possible problem because there's a risk that people just take as many surveys as they can and they don't care what they check box at all because they just want to get through as many surveys at all. But still, the researchers claim that these 1,991 participants were representative in terms of age, gender, and ethnicity for the UK. And I think there are checks to make sure that it's not nonsense replies. And as we shall see, the results make sense. The big takeaway is that the UK population is in favour of all types of policy instruments that the government has access to limit the climate crisis. Policies were divided into four categories by the researchers. One was regulation, which was harder things like banning the sales of fossil fuel powered cars or stopping drilling for oil, things like that. The next category was market instruments, carbon trading, things like that. Then you go into information tools or voluntary initiatives like non-binding product standards, things like that. So the public was for all of these kinds of interventions by the government, but there are nuances to what the public wanted. People generally didn't like the hard regulations and they didn't like market instruments as much as they liked information and voluntary initiatives. But the researchers pointed out to other studies that these things, the softer ones, are less effective. So you want to, if you want to achieve results, you should really do the hard stuff. Still, the harder measures were supported by over 65% of the participants. The less harsh policies were supported by between 78 or 87%. So there's a big public support for these kinds of interventions. The other thing that the study showed was that there's a divide between urban and rural areas. The Greater London area consistently was different from the rest of the country. Do you want to guess in what way? Were they more in favor of interventions or less?
More.
Well, probably.
More. More, yeah. Yeah, you're quite right. They were also in favor of harder regulations. So this is what the researchers had to say about that. Quote, drivers of these differences are both ideological and structural. People living in Greater London tend to believe less in the free market system compared to people in regions which has had significantly lower support for climate policies. This indicates that neoliberal ideology favoring free markets is discouraging climate action. So, okay, that's a little bit of a mouthful maybe. But what it means is that people living out in the country who have further to travel, they don't want bans on their petrol cars because they need them. They have more difficulties of getting around where they need to go than people living, you know, you could take the tube in London. You don't need a car for one thing. Also, there's a difference in ideology and education perhaps. But anyway, the big takeaway is that if Rishi Sunak is reducing climate goals as a populistic move, he is doing the wrong thing because people do want the climate crisis to be tackled by the government.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so he's wrong.
You know, the government should, before starting any kind of policy, should do a bit of research. It's not a bad idea to do surveys plus talk to researchers so that the science is right and then we know what the people think. And if the science is right and the people think differently, then there's still the dilemma of what to do. Well, for us skeptics, it's probably very obvious what we would do.
Mm.
We would follow the science and try to convince the public. But it's usually not the case. Look at what's going on with Germany and the energy policy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The public decided that nuclear power, bad.
Yeah.
And the politicians followed the public.
Yeah.
But at least they were listening to the people. Rishi Sunak is not even listening to anyone.
Beggars
he's
can't
not
be
listening
choosers,
to the
huh?
scientists and not listening to the people. So he's just based on gut feelings what he's doing. It's really interesting how you see this man. He comes across when he speaks and his whole physical appearance. You would think that he could not go as low as, for example, Boris Johnson. But you'll be wrong. That says a lot.
That's saying something, yeah. That's almost in itself really wrong, and I know that he received many really wrongs. Yeah.
But it seems he's becoming desperate now because he brought David Cameron back. Did you see that?
Yeah, I was surprised. But yeah.
Well, that's for, I think, another podcast who analyzes political things.
Yeah.
Which is not us.
Yeah.
Not us.
Yeah, thank you very much. And let's find out who's been really wrong lately, apart from Rishi Sunak, of course.
Yes, and this goes back to actually the 28th of October this year when Matthew Perry died. And now people might say, well, what does an American actor who played Chandler in Friends have to do with a European Skeptics podcast? And the thing is, yeah, the thing is that the international and thus European also anti-vax movement was very quick to jump onto Matthew Perry's death and use it for their own ways. He was very vocal about having had health problems coming from his drug addiction as a younger man and as a middle-aged man. He had to have surgeries. He was in a coma. He died 54 years old. And anti-vax people very quickly started to claim that he died from the COVID shot. Mm-hmm. Which, yeah, is in itself also really wrong. But the thing is that he very publicly actually sold a t-shirt that said vaccinated in the Friends logo. So he was for vaccination. He was for the COVID shot. And it's so absurd that these people are now saying, oh, see, he's a victim of the vaccination and he died from the COVID shot. And you know, remember all the health troubles I mentioned before, like the coma and the 15 rehab stints and the 14 surgeries and a bust bowel and stuff. Do you remember that? Mm. That was before he got his vaccination.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't invented back then. So I think we gave this award out to the anti-vax movement before, but for using the death of an actor that is mourned by many and for using this for their propaganda and calling him a victim of the COVID vaccination, the anti-vax movement and the anti-vax people received this week's prize for being really wrong.
Yeah, as they well should. Because they, but the reason they don't like him, of course, because he was standing up for COVID vaccinations, and that's why he becomes the enemy, and then they take these horrible digs at the person who died a terrible death.
Yeah, which tells me that they're like, this is one of many proofs that this is really like an ideology, that it's not that they want to, that they don't want to like protect children or whatever, but that it's really a, oh yeah, look, he's the enemy and now we kick him while he's on the ground, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or under.
Or under, yeah.
Thank you very much, Annika.
Thank you.
And lastly, before the end of the show, I'd like to turn to a recently introduced segment that we call Who's Quacking? Actually, when we came up with the idea of this segment, this guy was already on my mind to try and talk about. And now this last week, he has been all over the news again with yet another idiotic thing that he said. So what am I talking about? He's a celebrity. He used to be a fitness guru. Mm-hmm. He still is to some extent, but he has a fascinating history. He used to be like a police officer, and then he was massively overweight and he lost a lot of weight and then became a fitness trainer. And he got very well known after a while because he started writing about that story. And that was a big hit. He made his name under his acquired name, which was Norbert Schobert. Interestingly, the name Schobert can be written two different ways, with an accent on the O and without. And unfortunately, even he is not using it consistently. So in some of the legal documents that have been filed when he founded a couple of companies, because his name is attached to 13 different companies, he then came up with a product line that he called Norbi Update. And he used all kinds of different additives for people to be able to eat without having to worry about gain weight or still being able to lose weight even. Well, recently he had a clash with the Hungarian competition authority. They fined him big time because 40 million Hungarian forints is a big deal. Let me say that's about 100,000 euros. And he decided not to pay it in. So now it's one level up with the authorities. So probably this is the reason why he tries to rebuild his public profile now. And his public profile is about, well, getting views no matter what. And he has been doing that. So he sent his own 18-year-old son into the ring, into a television program that is called Box of the Stars. These are box matches between Hungarian stars of different trades. Yeah, he sent his 18-year-old son into the ring to replace himself. That was fascinating. And then what made the news recently, and it was a big hit again, was when one of the well-known television personalities interviewed him. And that was a long interview for lasted a whole day, and then it was all cut into a two-hour-long show. And he started making absolutely no sense. Like, he started denying the moon landing. He started questioning the validity of vaccinations. And he even said that science is holding people hostage with falsehoods all over the place. So this is the guy who has been proven to make no sense whatsoever. When the whole COVID situation started, he jumped on the bandwagon of, you know, you remember those who claim that worms are developing in the masks? Do you remember those?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That because of your breath and the moisture, they are developing in the masks. So he jumped on that bandwagon and we coined the phrase that he is the biochemist of the nation after he claimed that the formula, the chemical formula of cocaine was similar to that of sucrose. He just proved that he has absolutely no freaking idea what he's speaking about. It was because when you see the formula, it says C and a number after it, 17, age, 21, nitrogen, oxygen, 4. And because sucrose has a lot of C's and H's and O's in it as well, he decided that it's almost the same chemical formula.
No chemical knowledge for of high schoolers, you know?
So, yeah, so this is how he decided to argue against using sucrose. These are the kinds of arguments that he makes, and he used to be very popular. He used to be a big, big hit in the realm of fitness, and now he's kind of fallen, but he's still coming back to spread his nonsense, and a lot of people still buy his shit. So, yeah, I wanted to let everyone know that this guy is out there, and he is the main character in this week's Who's Quacking, because he quacks a lot.
I do like the name, though, Norbert Schorbert.
Yeah, me too.
I think that sounds good.
Schorbert, yeah, yeah, yeah. He was born Horvat. Ferenc Norbert Horvat. Okay. It's a long story how he got his name. But the fact that he's not even using it consistently with the accent and without the accent, I don't know.
I just feel like he's missing an R. He should be Norbert Schorbert. That's just what Schorbert, it is.
No, it's Schorbert.
I know.
So it's without the without the first R. It
would have had so much potential.
I know, it would be nice.
Still nice.
So much potential. The guy had a lot of potential, but he's just a quack. All right, enough of this. I think this marks the end of the show, which usually has to end with a quote. So, Annika, have you got one for us?
Yes, I've got one that fits very well to the twist of this episode. And it's by one Charles Darwin. Mm-hmm. And the quote is, "The science of geology is enormously indebted to Lyell, more so, as I believe, than to any other man who ever lived." End quote.
Hmm. So great praise for Lyell there.
By Charles Darwin, too. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Who happened to be a good friend of his? But yeah, a little bit of partiality probably on his part, but I think it's a quote that we can agree with.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay, so thank you very much, and I'd like to thank both of you, Annika and Pontus.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Many thanks to our listeners as well for tuning in. Please keep doing so, and until next week, goodbye.
Tschüss.
Hej då.
Bis lat.
This has been your ESP experience. The show is produced and recorded by the ESP.eu. Join us again next time, but until then, please send your feedback, comments, or death threats to info@theesp.eu. We would also love to hear your ideas and suggestions regarding future episodes, as well as news from your country of residence that might interest others across the continent. If you have a local event or organization to promote, please don't hesitate to let us know, as we are more than happy to help. All music in the program was written and performed by Keisha J. Gray and George Schwab and is used with their permission. Please check out our webpage at www.theesp.eu, follow us on Twitter at espodcast_eu, and like us on Facebook. I don't know how you can believe.
Saw a YouTube video about Ringo Starr's drumming earlier today.
Must have been very good. What are you doing?
I'm being Ringo.
Being Ringo. Okay. Cuvier's catastrophic... Cuvier's catastrophists...
I think we're looking at the catastrophe already here.
Sorry about that.
Ah, fuck. Sorry.
Now I don't feel that bad anymore.
But it's not me. It's the fucking Pope. Okay. I'll have to.
Yeah.
I'll have to.
Fuck the motherfucker. Fuck the motherfucker. Fuck the motherfucker.